Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
So, Phil, why don't you, before I get you started talking about meditation, I thought I better make something very clear up front for our listeners, many of whom may not be familiar with meditation in the Eastern sense of the word. I know in the Western sense of the word, we use the word meditation to mean to think deeply about, to ponder something. We might even use that in our church services or in spiritual discussions, Mormons. But when we talk about meditating about something, it seems like we really use that as a synonym for pondering, to simply think deeply about something. And when you think about where Mormons might practice meditation, or at least the Western definition or meaning of meditation, we might think about sacrament meeting, where we're supposed to be thinking deeply about the Savior. And we might consider that to be meditation, really pondering, thinking about the Savior. We might think about meditation occurring in the celestial room in the temples when we are wanting to commune with God. And there that word meditation might mean to us a deep prayerful attitude, maybe a very intimate dialogue with God. But maybe you can help us understand what does meditate and what does meditation mean in the Eastern context that we're going to be talking about.
Sure. I think you're exactly right. I think many folks, particularly in the church, see meditation as deep thinking, careful thought about spiritual or significant things. And in the pure sense of meditation, meditation is awareness beyond thought. So if you're thinking, even though it's careful pondering kinds of things, there's an appropriate place for that, that's not really meditation, and it's not really transformative. For a person to experience what I would call transformative spiritual growth, where there is a purification of the subconscious and the elimination of obstacles to soul nature unfolding, you have to be able to rest in a state of higher awareness that is above thought, that is beyond thought. Some people think they're meditating if they get into a semi-hypnotic trance. That's actually a state of awareness below thought. And although it has benefits as far as stress reduction and relaxation and just kind of tuning out from problems, that again is not doesn't result in spiritual awakening or spiritual transformation. So meditation in its truest sense is pure, conscious, awakened spiritual awareness that is above thought, beyond thought. Thought is a very limiting form of perception.
Okay. And before we go and talk about exactly how we arrive at that state of mind, which I think many of our listeners who are unfamiliar with meditation will have even a difficult time grasping the concept of what you're talking about. Before we circle back to that, let's talk a little bit about where does meditation come from in the Eastern sense? What traditions or schools of thought really gave birth to the Eastern practice of meditation?
Well, it came from India. And some people don't even realize that Buddhism originally started in India. But what happened was thousands of years ago, there were these ancient sages, seers, and their goal was to try and understand the nature of reality, understand the nature of what we would call God, to understand their inner essence of being. And in an effort to try to figure that out, they came up with a process that is referred to as self-inquiry. They learned very quickly that it was very difficult to determine, let's say you're trying to determine who am I or what am I? What is the essence of my nature, the essence of my being? Well, they learned very quickly that it was difficult to just simply figure that out, to reason that out. They could tell they didn't have the capability to do that. But what they did learn, also learn very quickly, was it was very easy to discern what they were not. And so they started this process that's called self-inquiry, and it's a very helpful spiritual practice to do before meditation, or before, you know, you start a meditative discipline. And it's simply asking these sorts of questions. Am I the body? Am I my body? And it doesn't take very long. It doesn't take much pondering to figure out that I'm not my body. If I am the body, which one? Am I the 3-year-old body or the 60-year-old body? Those are very, very different bodies. It's obvious that my body is changing. It changes dramatically, but I'm still here. If you cut somebody's arm off, are they suddenly, you know, 10 or 15% less there? Well, no. I mean, if you feel 15% less there, that's a psychological issue. You're still clearly intact. And so it doesn't take much thought to discern that I'm really something other than just my body. Well, then they move this inquiry into thoughts and emotions. Am I my thinking? And that's where, frankly, most people are. Most people really believe they are the mental activity that goes on in their head because they're so closely identified with it and the emotions that flow from that. Well, if you could slow your mind down and just grab one thought out, it's obvious that every thought has a beginning, it has a middle, and it has an end, and it's replaced by another thought. The same is true with emotions. And it became very obvious to them that, well, I can't be my thoughts because thoughts are coming and going, and I'm here observing them. And they came to one of the core philosophical tenets of yogic philosophy, which is, if I can observe it, I am not it. So if I can observe my body, if I can observe my thoughts, if I can observe my emotions, then obviously I'm something that's connected with this capability of observation. I'm not the thing that I am observing. So this is pretty much how this process of self-inquiry unfolded. And if you sit down and do that, and if you realize, okay, I'm not the body, and you kind of discard your sense of self from your body, and you realize I'm not the thinking that's going on in my head, and I'm not the emotions that come and go. And if you even think about your personality characteristics, they change sometimes. Sometimes you'll pick up a way of laughing that a friend laughs that way, and you find yourself doing that 5 years later, and it's a part of your personality. I mean, it's obviously baggage. And when you start subtracting body, thought, emotion, personality characteristics, you see what's left. That's the question. What's left? And what's left is your soul. What's left is your spirit. What's left is your essence of being. And you begin to realize that, wow, I spend so little time being aware of that part of me that is really me. All my time is lost in the needs and desires of the body and the functions of my mind and emotion and the interplay of my personality with other personalities. And you suddenly realize I spend most of my life interacting with things that really aren't a part of my essential nature.
So it sounds like you draw a distinction between the observed and the observer. Any of those things that can be observed, like the body, the thoughts, emotions, that's not you. That the real you is the observer that's observing in all those things. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
And so it sounds like what you're saying is that if there's this observer, if we can use an analogy, watching a television show, and that television show is all of their thoughts and all their emotions, that the problem is that it's like the person forgetting that he's sitting on the couch watching the television show and being so engrossed with the thoughts and emotions on TV that he starts to think he is the television show.
Well, I mean, I've had this experience. I think everybody's had this experience. You get so engrossed in the movie, it just grabs you in some way. You suddenly find yourself in body, in thought, in emotion, completely wrapped up in this movie. And the truth is, our lives as we experience them are just a big movie.
And so help us understand how this ties in then with the concept of meditation.
Meditation is the discipline that allows you to withdraw your attention and awareness from your body and the sensations of the body, from the thoughts in your mind, from the emotions related to those thoughts and the sensations in the body, to the images in your mind, the stories in your head about who you think you are. It's the discipline of withdrawing from all of that and beginning to experience yourself in a state of pure spiritual perception, to be able to experience the essence of your being, the essence of your soul nature. And with the objective of ultimately transferring your identity from the movie to your real essence of being. And in yogic philosophy, and I believe the gospel's taught in a variety of different ways, but I would say the gospel also would teach that the essence of your being is good. It's created in the image of God. The qualities of divinity are a part of the nature of our soul. And so to the extent that you can begin to identify with that which is really you, essentially you, which you discover within yourself is what Jesus referred to as the kingdom of God. Where is the kingdom? It's within you. So you begin to find within yourself joy, peace, an ability to love. My wife says to me, "You're patient all of a sudden. How did that happen?" Well, I was looking for patience outside of myself. I was setting a goal, hoping that Heavenly Father would bless me with patience as if He was going to pick it up at Walmart on the way to my house to give it to me. And what I discovered was that patience was a quality of my own soul that was already there. And so by allowing that to unfold, by spending time in meditation, that which I had desired became manifest because it was always there.
Interesting. And so I think it's worth noting here that these, you call them sages in India, just basically these wise men. It really sounds like we're looking at when humankind first began to develop psychology. That it's when the human mind started looking at itself in the mirror and realizing that it existed and trying to figure it out. And where did it go from there? Where did meditation spread to? I mean, you mentioned it started in India, so I'm assuming that this is with basically in Hinduism. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean Hinduism. is a huge umbrella. It encompasses many spiritual and religious practices, many cultural practices. It is a mammoth study, so to speak. And there are many, 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 I mean, there are thousands of different spiritual traditions encompassed by the term Hinduism.
My understanding is that the word Hindu just derives from the word Indus, the Indus River being the basically where Indian civilization began. Is that right?
That's correct. Well, unfortunately, as in any spiritual tradition, once it becomes organized, then there are certain psychological and social things that evolve where people get into power positions, and then to maintain power, they act in certain ways, and then the essence of what the tradition was about gets lost, and then there's all of a sudden an interplay of orthodoxy and power structure, and Buddhism is given birth because this person we refer to as the Buddha, which means the awakened one, he realized that the religious leaders of his day were acting out of character, that the priests were corrupt, that they were concealing from people the teachings of spiritual life and spiritual awakening, which in his mind should be offered freely to all and not be sold or held back. So... you know, he essentially was a thorn in the side to the Hindu leadership of his day, and upon his death, you know, Hinduism Buddhism was essentially flushed out of India. It was a power struggle, and of course, Buddhism then spread to China and Japan and Korea and. All the places where it's prominent now, but it all of this started in India.
So it might be fair to say that Buddha was for Hinduism who Jesus was for Judaism, that they were both reformers, and that they then that their followers then began an entirely new religion, that the followers of Jesus becoming Christians, and the followers of Buddha, who were formerly Hindus, becoming Buddhists. Is that right?
Yeah, generally speaking. And of course, it didn't take many years after Buddha's death before his disciples started arguing about how things should be done. And of course, that fragmented into the various forms of and schools of Buddhism that we have around the planet. So he would be horrified, frankly.
So it sounds like we've got this core of wisdom and spiritual insight in Hinduism and Buddhism, with a pretty thick overlay of man-made additions and the corruption and unfortunately perverse incentives that's created when any sort of good idea becomes institutionalized.
Right. And in the history of yoga, and we really haven't defined that, most people think of Hatha yoga, which is this these physical postures and routines that are done for balance and flexibility and strength. I mean, that's just a very small portion of the whole yogic system. The word yoga itself means union. The implication is union with God, union of the soul with spirit. And it refers to the state of yoga or the state of enlightenment or awakened spiritual awareness, which results from union with God. And it also refers to the disciplines and the teachings and the path that lead one to that union.
So yoga is more than stretching, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And properly understood.
Yeah, it's a whole lifestyle, and it's a very, in some respects, because there are many different traditions and emphases, it's a very varied and complex sort of thing, but the objective is always self-understanding, self-awareness, and union with God or existence or reality. I mean, that's the ultimate objective. And I actually forgot where we were headed with this. I got sidetracked.
Well, I'll help you out. That's what I'm here for. Yeah. So, I understand that meditation is a common practice both in Hinduism and Buddhism, in all of their different permutations, and so that's a commonality, and that from Hinduism and Buddhism, there have arisen several different types of meditation. And why don't you just give us a thumbnail sketch of the major types of meditation practice there are?
Oh boy!
Maybe I'll help you out. if you could walk us through just 30,000 foot level mindfulness meditation, mantra based meditation, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I started with mindfulness meditation. It's a wonderful practice. The idea is learning to do things consciously, learning to observe things in a fully conscious way, learning to refine your powers of observation and attention, and learning how to connect simple activities with a deeper spiritual reality. Most meditative practices work with breath at some level or at some point. Most initial practices begin with observation of one's breath, because you want your breath to be settled. There's a relationship between the quality of breath and what's happening in your mind. If your breath is unsettled, your mind's going to be unstable. So most meditation practices will begin with a stabilizing and settling of diaphragmatic breathing in a nice gentle way. It's just one way of settling and calming the mind, so it's easier to still. Mindfulness meditation extends even to activities. I mean, you can do walking meditations where as you're walking, you learn to be mindful of the movement of your body. In other words, you sense very profoundly how your body feels, what sensations are going on. A lot of meditation, we talked earlier about Vipassana meditation, where you're observing the thoughts and sensations and emotions that might be flowing through your body and mind, but being able to witness them without becoming involved in them. These are different forms of meditation that are designed to increase awareness so that when you make choices, when you interact with people, when you make decisions, you're developing a skill and an ability to be thoughtful, to be mindful, to do, to think, act in the way that you really want to and not from patterns or conditioning.
Mm-hmm. And so in mindfulness meditation, the focus is on your breathing then. You're seated comfortably, your eyes are closed, and you try to focus your mind on nothing other than your breathing. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the way most meditation starts. Because again, you want a settled breath to have a settled mind. Some people can do activities mindfully. My wife is an expert at performing activities in a mindful way. So she can do chores around the house. She can. We have chickens and rabbits and dogs that we care for. Her animal care is a spiritual practice for her because she cares for these animals in a focused, mindful way. In other words, full attention, not lost in thought, not aware of something else, not wanting to be somewhere else, but deeply rooted in the present moment. Something we haven't talked about is when you're the way the mind functions and the way thought patterns develop, we tend to spend most of our time in the past and in the future in our thinking. We ruminate over things that have happened in the past. We're pretty much dictated by this dualism of pleasure and pain. So we think about things that were painful, and then we project into the future how we're going to avoid that. And we remember things that were pleasurable, and we project into the future how we're going to maximize that. And our thoughts go back and forth in that sort of fashion. And anything that's conceptual in your head that's related to past and future has nothing to do with reality. It's a movie. And it's either memory or it's fantasy. And spirit, you know, we talk about God living in an eternal now. Spirit is a present moment reality. You can only experience spirit consciously if you are in the present moment. So if you can, let's say, care for, I'm going to use my wife as an example. If she can care for a sick rabbit sitting on her lap, she's feeding it, she's giving it medicine, she's stroking it, she's doing it with such intense present moment awareness, it becomes a spiritual experience because she's connecting in the present moment to the reality of life. And so that activity becomes spiritually nourishing and to some degree spiritually awakening. And that's the essence of mindfulness.
Mindfulness is a word that I know for me I'd never heard of the word mindfulness, I think, until I picked up, I think the first book on Eastern thought that I read was the Upanishads, some old Hindu scripture. And I think the, whoever the editor was who did commentary would talk about mindfulness. It seemed like such an awkward word to be mindful. I had no way of understanding what that means, but, to see if I can summarize correctly for our listeners, it sounds like being mindful means not being lost in thought, not daydreaming, not letting your mind escape and wander away from the present moment where it's agonizing about the past or worrying about the future, but to be fully focused, aware, and present on the present moment. And that sort of activity, that when your mind is focused on the present, which is the only physical reality, because as you pointed out, the past doesn't physically exist anymore. The future doesn't physically exist yet. The only thing that really exists is the present. And so when our mind is focused on the present, we are in a mindful state. Is that correct?
That's correct. And you are in touch with reality.
Okay,
not a conceptual reality in your head. So that was very nicely explained.
Okay. And so if mindfulness is the goal of mindfulness meditation, bringing back in the concept of focusing our attention on our breath, I heard something interesting recently that the word respiration for breathing, also the same root in the word spirit and in inspiration.
That's correct.
That the concept of spirit, spirituality, inspiration, the etymology of those words, it comes from the root for breathing. So, words came from somewhere, and it seems like at some point early on, the whole concept of spirit, spirituality, inspiration was linked with the breath. Is that right?
Yeah, spirit has always been linked with breath. The word spirit and breath, as I understand it, is in Hebrew and in Greek is the same word. And when Jesus, for example, if you ask the average Mormon, how did Jesus give his disciples the Holy Ghost, 9 out of 10 will say, by the laying on of hands. But if you look in John 20, if my memory is correct, he breathed on them. when he gave them the Spirit. I mean, it's a very profound thing. At our physical creation, as is described in Genesis, God breathes into us or puts into us our spirit. Those two things are linked. And so here's Jesus now initiating spiritual rebirth, and he does it by breathing on them. So spirit has always been linked with breath. It's a great place to start a meditation practice, and it's because the goal of meditation is to move from the grosser material states of awareness to more subtle and ultimately pure spiritual awareness. Breath is in between those. So if you can move your attention and awareness, do you see, into your breath, it's more subtle than the material realm, and you're starting that process of moving to more subtle states of awareness.
Yeah, and so in our breathing again, if our object is to be focused on the present moment, the fact that you and I and our listeners are breathing right now is a great reminder that we're alive here in the present moment. That's what enables us to be alive. And so by focusing on our breath, this is the way I explained it to my daughters recently, kind of circling back to the point you made about our minds liking to wander off into the past and into the future. I said, imagine if you had a television set that when you put it on a channel, it would just randomly skip around, you know, forward 10 channels, back 20 channels, and was bouncing all around and wouldn't just stay on one channel. I mean, that sort of a television, you would say was broken, was useless, was a piece of junk, and you'd throw it away. And yet, how much our minds act very much like that sort of a television that won't just stay on one channel. And so I told my daughters that the whole point of mindfulness meditation is to train our minds to stay on one channel. And so that way, instead of our thoughts controlling us, we control our thoughts. We put the remote in our hands, and we decide what our mind is allowed to think about and when. Is that a good summary?
Well, that's a great summary. Eckhart Tolle, in his book Power of Now, gives the example, you know, assuming that, you know, you've been on a street in a big city and you observe what appears to be a mentally ill person walking by you, and they're just babbling. They're talking out loud, and nothing makes any sense, and it's just a rambling of random thoughts. And he points out the fact that if you put a speaker in somebody's ear where everyone could hear your thoughts, it would sound exactly the same way. That's the way our mind works. It's just a hodgepodge of random thoughts just circling around. And the sad thing is, because our most basic instincts are survival, whether it's physical or psychological, our thoughts instinctively tend to be survival in nature. They tend to be negative in that sense, and they tend to be fear-based. And so you wonder why there's dis-ease, discomfort, when you don't have management of your thinking processes.
Interesting. And so that's an interesting example. We would call that craziness, right? We would call that insanity, someone walking along, you know, babbling to themselves, and yet that sort of insanity or craziness, I guess what Tola's saying is going on in our heads. And it kind of sounds like, again, turning back to the television analogy, as if the television show that pops into our head is a really graphic, violent horror show, or in other words, something that's just not really healthy to be thinking about. And so the idea is to learn how to turn that negative channel off. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you could, I mean, you can do this. If you can just sit quietly and observe your own thoughts, it's going to sound like the crazy person on the street. I mean, that's what's going on in our heads. The fact that we grab onto a particular logical train of thought and get that together and then communicate it in some way, well, that's nice. But what's going on most of the time is this ramble. And it's ultimately disturbing to the nervous system.
And okay, so I think we've covered mindfulness meditation, at least a little thumbnail sketch of it. Why don't you talk about, and you mentioned that this is a good place for meditators to start, is to start by trying to first develop the capacity to be mindful, to bring our minds, our attention to the present, to train our minds to block out the past and the future, and to stay on one channel. Once someone has developed a good capacity for mindfulness, what is another sort of meditation or type of meditation that's good to graduate to? You mentioned mantra-based meditation, and would now be an appropriate time to discuss that?
Well, sure. I'm definitely not an expert in all forms of meditation, and people have done amazing things just with attention on their breath as far as purifying their minds and subconscious and opening themselves up to spiritual awareness. I like mantra meditation because it's a more subtle form that can lead you into higher states of awareness, I believe, a little more quickly. The objective in – you certainly want to have a relaxed diaphragmatic breath going as a baseline. So I always – I mean after my devotional practices and prayer and so forth, I always have a little bit of attention on my breath. And a mantra meditation, you're simply, whether one has been given to you or whether you select it yourself, a mantra is simply a word or a phrase or a sound that is used to focus your awareness and attention. Because if you can't develop your ability to concentrate, you're never going to be able to meditate. A lot of what people call meditation is really concentration. So in mantra meditation, a word or two words or a phrase is chosen that inspires you, or it's uplifting to you, or it's a sound that causes your mind not to be distracted, whatever the purpose is. And you begin repeating this sound in your mind. And the discipline here is to hold your attention fully and completely on that sound. I normally teach it in a way where people link a sound with their breath. So there's a sound on inhalation, a sound on exhalation. And to get it where those two things flow as if they're one thing. And then what happens is the breath should start becoming so subtle it'll take energy to maintain awareness on your breath, and you don't want that. So you let the breath go. And now you're attention is simply on the sound, the repetition of the sound in your mind. The word mantra comes from the word mind and device, or mind and tool, the root words. And the implication is that a mantra is a device of the mind to transcend the mind. So you're using the mind to transcend the mind, and the mantra meditation is a way of doing that. So at first, at least in my case, I was holding on to this mantra pretty tightly because my attention was easily distracted. If you're agitated, if you got stuff going on in your life, if there's physical distress, emotional, psychological distress, relationship problems, then your mind's agitated. It's hard to concentrate. It's hard to focus. So that's the discipline at first. You absolutely have to learn how to focus your attention and learn to concentrate, or you'll never be able to experience meditation. The advantage of the mantra is it is even sound is even more subtle than breath. So as subtle as breath is, you can hear somebody breathing. You can put a stethoscope on there and hear the breath. You can't hear a sound being repeated in somebody's head. And the other nice thing about sound is as your power of concentration develops and you're able to hold your attention on that mantra, you can begin letting the mantra fade in your awareness. So rather than having to repeat it constantly in your mind, you now start listening to it. See, listening to it is more subtle than generating it. And so you now start listening to this mantra, and if you can keep your attention focused on it, then you start allowing it to fade. Well, what's happening is you're establishing one-pointed or single-pointed awareness, which interestingly enough, in the 88th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, we're told that if we have our mind single, a single mind to the glory of God, then sanctification takes place. And that's exactly what happens. You have brought your mind to a single focal point of attention. That single point now is the only barrier between you and pure spiritual awareness. So the goal is to ultimately let the mantra lead you into pure consciousness, pure awareness. You let it fade and fade and fade until it finally fades away. And then you find yourself in a state of pure consciousness, of pure spiritual awareness. You don't have body consciousness and awareness. Your thoughts have now been surrendered. And you're now able to rest, to commune in the presence of the Lord.
Could you give us an example then? It might be difficult to do, but in your own personal practice, can you give us some examples of mantras that you might use? And exactly, give us a demonstration of how you would use them in syncing it up with your breathing. Again, just for our listeners who are new to the concept of meditation, the whole idea being, and I guess we can put it in the LDS lingo that you used, helping you have an eye single to something, to have a single point of focus, and thereby gaining mastery over our minds, being able to control our minds, which then allows us to commune with true spirituality. But give us a demonstration, if you will, of using a mantra.
Okay. In some yoga traditions, it's believed that a guru has to give you a mantra, that it's sacredly empowered and it will work better. I don't know that that's necessarily true. Frankly, any phrase or sound that's inspiring to you can be used as a mantra. For years, I used a Sanskrit mantra that was given to me as a part of Deepak Chopra's program. It was very effective. Later, years into my meditation, I had a mantra that was self-manifesting, that kind of represented my development of yoga with Christian discipleship. But just an example, I give people the option of be still. There's that verse in Psalm 46:10 that summarizes this whole thing. Be still and know that I am God. Well, it's obvious in scriptural teaching that the objective of all spiritual disciplines is to ultimately know God, not know about God, but to have intimate personal knowledge through communion with God, and that knowledge is sanctifying and transforming. Well, what's the key to gaining that knowing? It's stillness. Well, it's obviously not talking about stillness of the body, or half of the army would be enlightened after a day of standing at attention. So it's clearly talking about stilling the mind, which is the core discipline of meditation. And it is in the stillness of that mind that this spiritual knowledge unfolds. So, heck, why not take this phrase, be still and know that I am God? The most simple way to do this is just to use those words, be still. it still has the meaning in your awareness that I'm being still to know God. So just the use of those words provides a wonderful intent and purpose for your meditation. It is spiritual in nature, and I'm seeking God, and I'm seeking a deeper understanding of myself. So I would teach a person to, when they inhale, to establish themselves in a nice, slow, gentle, diaphragmatic breath. When they inhale, in their mind, they say the word be. And when they exhale, in their mind, they say the word still. So the words be, still, become intimately associated with inhalation and exhalation. And that just continues. Now, I've had some people worry about this business of vain repetition. The key word here is vain. There's nothing vain about any of this. You're calming and stilling the mind for the purpose of communing with God. There's not a vain thing about this. And you need that repetition to still this menagerie of thoughts that's always circulating. So you spend 10, 15, 20 minutes repeating this sound linked with your breath. And again, at some point, you let the breath go, and you're just simply repeating this mantra, be still, in your mind. And, you know, it might take weeks, it might take a couple of months, but at some point, you're going to find that, let's say in the course of 20 minutes, when you first start, your mind, you find yourself lost in thought 100 times. I mean, that can be very frustrating, and you feel like you're failing in some way. But the discipline is to gently and patiently just return to the mantra. If you're lost in thought, you just patiently come back to that mantra and you just stick with that. And guess what? Next week, you're only distracted 80 times. And the following week, it's 60 times. And you'll get to a point where you can hold your attention on the mantra for 20 minutes and maybe only be distracted 3 or 4 times. I mean, that's miraculous. I mean, that is an amazing thing. Now, you might think this is slow progress, but the whole time that you're doing this, stress chemicals are being reduced, your nervous system is being calmed, your immune system is actually being strengthened, the aging process is slowing down, and your ability to ultimately experience your essence of being is unfolding. So even though you might not think there's much going on, there is a tremendous amount going on that maybe you're not aware of at the moment. And once you can hold your attention on that mantra, only being occasionally distracted, then you start letting that thing fade and letting that thing lead you into a state of higher consciousness. In other words, the whole idea is not a blank mind and a stuporous trance. The idea is awakened awareness, enlightened awareness, awareness above and beyond thought.
And so if I can just summarize for the listeners, it sounds like there's no belief that these mantras are magic words. There's no hocus pocus, you know, associated with them. That basically the mantra is simply, the purpose of it is to provide something to focus on. And that by focusing on the mantra, whatever it may be, and learning to focus on that and keep out the distractions that try to get our mind to wander away, that we're able to develop this capacity to overcome the distracting influence of our thoughts and our emotions, to no longer be caught up in our thoughts and emotions, which oftentimes are very negative, which, as you point out, are insubstantial, are not real, insofar as they have to do with the present, with the past or the future. Is that a fair summary there?
Yeah. Now, to be fair, that is a very effective use of mantra. Now, the truth is, in most yoga traditions, there are mantras that are believed to have certain capacities and powers and abilities.
Interesting.
In some of those traditions, it is clearly superstitious. However, there are certain, in many yoga traditions, mine in particular, the yoga tradition I'm a part of in particular, there are certain mantras that are believed to be able to assist to clear energy, negative energy within your system, to purify the nervous system, to awaken certain spiritual forces and energies, not in a magic kind of way, but in a way that a vibration assists the purifying and cleansing of the nervous system and brain, so you're more capable of spiritual perception. Now, you don't have to get into any or all of that. You can use mantra, as I just simply explained it, for the purpose of concentration. What I didn't explain is that meditation isn't something that you make happen. It's not something that you can do. What you can do is learn how to concentrate and to open your awareness to spiritual perception. Meditation is actually a process that flows spontaneously when you attain a certain state of concentration. And you'll sense when meditation flows. It is a flow of grace. It's a flow of God's love and grace is what it is. And what will happen is that your awareness and attention will naturally flow toward that and with that. And that's when you are actually in meditation. And it's that process that is transformative and ultimately leads you into this state of yoga or union with God.
Okay. And I'd like to channel our discussion now onto the concept of awakening, which is something you discuss in your Mormon Mantras essay. If I'm not mistaken, the word Buddha means enlightened one, and that another way to translate enlightenment or to be enlightened is to be awake. And so, can you help bring us from this concept of mindfulness then to this concept of becoming awakened through meditative practice, which of course implies that we are all, before we engage in meditative practice, in a state of slumber, right. That we're asleep. Can you explain those concepts to us, because they're very important in meditative practice?
They are. And frankly, lest I be too narrow, it's not all about Hinduism and Buddhism or yoga and Buddhism. There are other traditions around – spiritual traditions around the planet who have established meditative practices. And there's a whole dimension, a whole range of Christian mysticism that has a rich tradition of meditative practices. But whether you're talking Christian or Buddhist or Hindu or any others, all of the scriptures and all of the teachings in any of these mystical or meditative traditions deal with this business of being awake or being asleep. I mean, you can read that in the Book of Mormon or even the Doctrine and Covenants. Those concepts are in there. What does it mean to be asleep? It means you are lost in that which is ultimately not real. Okay, you're lost in the movie. You're lost in the story in your head about what you think the world and reality is about. The other thing you're lost in is conditioned perception, thought, emotion, and behavior. I've spent years asking large groups of people to ponder the question, what percent of your perceptions, thoughts, reactions to those thoughts and perceptions and behaviors are the result of conscious, aware decision-making, and how much of that, what percent is related to just patterns, scripting, conditioning, reactions. And although you'll have one or two people that will try to argue, you know, they have 50 or more percent conscious awareness, what amazes me is that most people, when they ponder that, realize very quickly that most of their perceptions and the responses of their perceptions, frankly, are patterns. They're patterns that are established and have been established in their lives since they were very young. And people who study this will tell you that 90 to 95% of our perceptions and our responses to what we perceived are, in fact, conditioned responses. So, I do marriage counseling for 20 years. I have couples that come to see me with pure intent. They're willing to do all the homework I've asked them to do. They want to be better spouses. They want to be better parents. We start the work, and you know, they'll make some improvements, and those improvements will last for 2 or 3 days, and then they'll come back the next week and report, I don't know what happened. We did the same thing again. You know, we fought about the same stuff the same way again. You know, what's going on? Well, what's going on is people are stuck in their conditioned patterns. And one of the reasons that counseling and psychotherapy is notoriously has low rates of success, let me say that, is because people rarely, if ever, break outside of their conditioning. And that, scripturally speaking, is being asleep. Now, in the church, we talk a lot about using our free agency. Well, if only 5 to 10% of your perception and thought and emotion and behavior is free and available for you to use consciously, you don't have much free agency. I think rather than talking about using our free agency, we need to be talking about how do I expand my free agency? And that's one of the things that meditative disciplines and practices do. They break up these conditioned patterns. They allow the brain to work more freely, more consciously, more aware, so that you see things differently, you see things more clearly, you think about them more broadly and clearly, your reactions are more measured and more reflective of your inner nature. And so you find yourself thinking and desiring and acting in a way that's in harmony with your own soul, that's in harmony with the nature of God and the way you really want to live. That's freedom. That's awakening. That's liberation. And that's what this core discipline of meditation is all about. It's about assisting this process of awakening.
So it sounds like a synonym for awakening here can be liberation, and that a synonym for being asleep is enslavement, that we're basically trapped and limited by our reflexive, conditioned responses to situations in life, that rather than actually acting in a very careful, deliberate, voluntary way, that we're often blurting things out or reacting in a somewhat involuntary way based on our conditioning. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's the experience of most people, and that's why relationship work is so difficult.
Uh-huh. And so how does meditation then, how is that a tool or a method of achieving this liberation or this awakening?
Well, it's because your soul is free. Within each person is the nature of God. And that nature is unbounded and unlimited. It is not restrictive and narrow like ordinary human perception and thought. The problem is we identify ourselves with our perceptions and with our thoughts and with the personalities that develop around that. And so we live in a very narrow, restricted point of view. So to suddenly be able to shift your identity from that to this infinite nature of your own being opens up a world of possibilities. And what happens, again, in this meditative process is the purifying of your subconscious. So much of these patterns are a result of what's happening subconsciously. So to have the structure of the brain refined and purified, to have the subconscious purified, to have your identity shifted to the infinite nature of the soul, which is, you know, which nature is goodness and joy and love and peace, is transforming, it's liberating, and it allows you to live with awareness, with consciousness.
Okay, and let's circle back here to the concept of mantras, because I'd like now to discuss, picking back up our discussion of your essay, Mormon Mantras. And you explained earlier how the word mantra literally means mind tool, and so these mantras are tools for helping us shape our minds. You point out in your essay that mantras exist all around us, and unfortunately they're not always healthy, that we've got some positive, helpful mantras, but that we also have plenty of negative, harmful mantras as well. And you then went into a discussion of how when you discovered this concept of mantras, how it gave you a new perspective from which you could view your experience within Mormonism, and that you began to notice that within Mormonism we have certain mantras. And so why don't you discuss that a bit for us? What were some of the mantras that you noticed we have within Mormonism?
Well, yeah, in some respects, this is kind of a play on words. You know, a meditation mantra is a particular device used to refine people's concentration so they can have the experience of meditation. We also use the word mantra in our culture to refer to slogans or catchphrases that people use to structure their thoughts. And I just began, for whatever reason, one day I just started becoming aware of what I was calling Mormon mantras. They are the catchphrases that provide structure and unity in our subculture of Mormonism. And as I began to listen and record these mantras, then I began, you know, wondering, are these helpful to spiritual awakening or are these harmful? Affirmations could be looked at as a, you know, as a form of mantra, and a lot of people do affirmation work, which can be really helpful. Using affirmations is a way of trying to structure the subconscious so that you perceive and react in a different way. I would probably say that although that's helpful, it's probably a little more laborious and difficult road than the transformation that takes place once somebody can establish a good meditative practice. That probably does more to purify and restructure the subconscious than the work of affirmations. But I think it is important to have a awareness of what are the mantras in my own mind, what are the mantras in my culture and subculture, and what influences do these have on me or my community. And what I began to notice, I had been, as a military chaplain, I'm doing services on the base on Sundays, so I'm not in church. So for 17 out of my 20 years as a chaplain, I was not in sacrament meeting or Sunday meetings. So to suddenly come back to church and be attending meetings every Sunday, I just was more keenly aware of the kinds of things that were being said. The first thing that I noticed was, without question, the number one Mormon mantra is, I know the church is true. 20, 30 years ago, or at least when I joined the church back in 1970, when people got up in testimony meetings, they were saying, I know the gospel is true. And all of a sudden, I'm hearing, I know the church is true. And I thought, I wasn't quite sure when this shift took place, but I found it to be very significant, because all of the children, 8, 9, 10 years old, getting up in testimony meetings in my ward, almost all of them, 90% of the time, would start with, I know the church is true. And then they might say something else and sit down. Well, what began to dawn on me was, if it is the church that's true, then subconsciously what's being programmed in is, if it's the church that's true, then what's really important is my relationship to the organization. And so I think it creates a generates a focus on, how am I seen by the organization? How do I relate to the organization? What's my status within the organization? Because if that's what's true, if I'm okay with it, then I'm going to be okay. And I found that not to be a very helpful thing in terms of spiritual focus. So that's just one example of how mantras take over our perception, and then the subconscious effect that it has.
And I'm reading here from your essay. You provided a list of some of the mantras that you noticed. I know the church is true, of course, is on the top of the list. Another one being, but the church is still true. Another one, follow the prophet or follow the brethren. Keep the commandments, sustain the Lord's chosen. I'm active in the church. I have a testimony. Obedience is the first law of heaven. And you list several more. And so actually, I think it'd be good if I read a little paragraph that struck me from your essay. You say, there's no question that Mormon mantras and teaching focus on authority and commandments. The benefit is safety and predictability. However, this focus creates boredom and hampers spiritual growth. The biggest complaint I hear from faithful mainstream Mormons is that so many of our meetings and classes are boring. Contrast these emphases and the resultant boredom to what happens when people live by principles and spirit. Passion and excitement arise when we move into unpredictable paths in response to the allure of faith. Neither life nor spiritual growth is safe and predictable. Spiritual living is creative, which means new and wonderful things can emerge with each step. Living by faith is being open to the wisdom of uncertainty. And I want to give you the opportunity to expand on that idea a little bit.
Yeah, certainty is a key concept in Mormonism. To know something for sure, to know that something is certain. And of course, anything that we know for sure is something that's happened in the past. And we kind of lock down on that. And organizationally, I mean, organizations always worry about unpredictable things happening in the future that might be detrimental. So there's sometimes a hesitancy to move into the unknown. I mean, I've received hundreds of letters from active Mormons who are reporting spiritual stagnation, boredom at church, wanting a richer, deeper, fuller, more vibrant spiritual life, but they're afraid to do anything outside of mainstream Mormon spiritual practices because they might be open to what they fear is ungodly influences. And so they hold back doing the same things and having the same results. And the truth is, spiritual growth is unpredictable. It is creative. It should not be feared because God is out there. If your spiritual growth is legitimate, then, you know, according to the scriptures, the mysteries, the things you don't know or you're not aware of now, should be unfolding as you're growing spiritually. So new, exciting, interesting, soul-nourishing things should be unfolding to you. These are things that you aren't aware of or don't know about. And if you're not going to risk that, then your spiritual life is going to be stagnant. It's going to be boring. As you know, organizations like predictability. They like stability. They don't want uncertainty. And you have to be willing to risk uncertainty if you're going to find this vibrant spiritual growth. I would say it's just nothing to be feared because it's God unfolding the mysteries of life unto us.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonstories.org. To keep the podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonstories.org. Music for this podcast was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. The Mormon Stories logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening. Still